here on, I think this is all the trail.
I found the recorder, I guess.
I believe all this is fine.
And even like the connections between the amp, is it residual?
Probably, I'm guessing, I don't know. Again, I wasn't part of the install. I can't imagine we did enough, but they were doing everything on computers in here, so. They were doing all the, whenever we found an issue, they'd come back, come running back to their computers.
So is it just the four Sirian speakers, that's it, in here?
You've got those, and there's a floor speaker right in front of the podium.
Okay.
Facing the podium, so.
That's his fold-back monitor?
Right.
Okay. And then, does it have its own output, operator?
The oxes.
Okay.
Master control gives phone lines, and then these are the needed PCs.
Okay. Is it for, or is it operator one, operator two?
I don't know what it's for.
Okay.
I think it's like signal one, signal two.
So this is basically when someone does a call in?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. We haven't done that for a very long time. Which is fine.
And channel four is just an unused channel?
Yeah, that's probably the other problem channel. Because what we were trying to do is separate them, because for the longest time, we had the two mics on one channel, so I asked for, when we were changing things in here a long time ago, I asked for separation between the podium and the press box. Just because that's why it's easier to get through your head, especially with the white one here. Then this is fine, I mean, it's still, I've been doing it long enough, it just.
Now, any change is painful. So I do like how they do their underlining on the podium in the folder. And then they can turn off the cadence and make the poetry reading.
So you're going to have to do a copy of us?
Yeah.
Which I'm sure he got from Reddit or somewhere else. A lot of other craziness that are on.
So Master Control uses the two panels for graphics?
Yeah. Well, don't do it a lot, but it's just in case, you know, they'll show maps up there and stuff. They'll pick up the charts and
we don't ever worry about them, like, kind of video them.
Yeah, I have.
Okay. something, cause they.
Okay.
Then you just hit the pizza play button for it to start recording.
And you basically start with the unit one?
No, we wait until the door, yeah, the door opens, cause we don't always get in the morning. So I just wait until the, that's the first thing I do as soon as the, they walk in the door, I hit that and then I'm in the door public.
Okay.
Cause I take these off, cause these are never gonna be, you know, on the port from my pan where I go in the middle of this, so I always take that off, especially here. You know, that be clanking and things.
Yeah.
You remember Fred, well, he used to send out this email at the bar, you know, cause he was at the bar's restaurant, so he's pay attention to that man by the time you're. No, I'd rather be just like you. I'm actually just gonna have to guess the part, they don't know me and I don't know them.
It's warm in here today.
It's.
It's warm in here.
It's warm, it's not enough.
It's
here, you guys, yes, there's up to. I mean, I'm.
Oh, really?
It's like two and a half or.
So. Like, tight.
Yeah, and in general, I don't like it, it's messy.
Not the worst.
First lady, I've seen her at the lighthouse.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I remember when there was a competition in the summer. She was breathing out, but it was like 15 minutes. The shortest, I guess, is 7 minutes, somebody said.
Huh.
But now we need to play with those other words. Times has changed.
And COVID breaking over at the house, poor little Google.
Oh, yeah, that's really my mom's.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can only imagine. I'm gonna turn on my comedy shows and say I'm being like a dick for 5 minutes.
Yeah. You gotta have some levity somewhere.
That's the one thing I don't appear to want that anymore, is I remember back in the day and, you know, just the crew is okay now that travels. Alright, there's one or two guys that are okay, but it's not like the old guys, you know, heading.
Sean, you're a brave man for sitting in that seat. I won't tell anyone. Good to see everyone. Before we get to it, let me just say just a moment of personal privilege to say thank you for everyone who reached out with the warm wishes and regards over the past couple weeks. I very much appreciate it. Want to also be sure to thank my team and others in the department who were in a position to stand up so I could take a step back for a couple days. The past 10 days have not always been fun, but I'm extraordinarily grateful to have the team around me to be able to work with all of you, and also extraordinarily grateful to have benefited from safe and effective vaccines that I know prevented serious illness in this case. So now we'll make the pivot from public health to foreign policy. Have just a couple elements at the top. Today I have the pleasure of welcoming the Special Envoy to Advance the Human Rights of LGBTQI plus persons, Jessica Stern, to the department as she officially assumed her duties late last month. This appointment reflects the Biden-Harris' administration's commitment to advance and to protect the human rights of LGBTQI plus persons at home and abroad. Prior to joining the department, Special Envoy Stern served as Executive Director of Outright Action International, based in New York, where she specialized in gender, sexuality, and human rights globally. At Outright, she helped register LGBTQI plus organizations internationally, secure the mandate of the United Nations Independent Expert on Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity, expand the UN General Assembly resolution to include gender identity, and founded the UN LGBTQI core group. You can read her full biography on the department's website. We look forward to working with Special Envoy Stern as she leads department efforts to advance the administration's priorities, and that includes pursuing an end to violence and discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, gender identity or expression, and sex characteristics. Finally, we are concerned and disappointed by recent reports from Tunisia on infringements on freedom of the press and expression and the use of military courts to investigate civilian cases. It is essential for the Tunisian government to uphold its commitments to respect human rights as outlined in the Tunisian constitution and affirmed in Presidential Decree 117. We also urge Tunisia's president and new prime minister to respond to the Tunisian people's call for a clear roadmap for a return to a transparent democratic process involving civil society and diverse political voices. So with that, happy to turn to your questions.
Sure.
Start wherever. Matt, Sean.
Sure.
All right, called you Matt.
I want to imitate.
Yeah, please. I hope you don't.
Perhaps start in Iran.
Sure.
Just a couple of elements there. Reb Mali apparently talked today with a senior official from South Korea. This comes as South Korea, the Republic of Korea, is in a dispute with Iran over some $7 billion in frozen assets. Was this the topic of the discussion? Do you see any headway on that?
Well, so Special Envoy Mali did, in fact, have a conversation with his counterpart in South Korea. This is not the first conversation they've had. Special Envoy Mali routinely speaks to his counterparts in the P5 plus one, as well as in other parts of the world. And this includes in the Indo-Pacific with our ROK allies in this regard. They spoke, and Rob issued a tweet on their conversation to confirm it took place. The ROK has been a stalwart partner, the ROK, and we see eye to eye when it comes to the utility of a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA. When it comes to the issue you referenced, we appreciate the ROK's vigorous enforcement of existing sanctions. Those sanctions do remain in effect, as you know, until and unless we are able to reach that mutual return to compliance.
So the $7 billion is still, there has been no movement on that, basically it's still there.
I don't have any update on that, that's right.
Can I ask you something else that you've brought
before?
Sure. You've been asked this many times before, but in terms of the resumption of indirect talks in Vienna, an Iranian official yesterday, I believe it was, said could resume within days. Do you have anything to say on that in terms of things?
Well, we have heard similar statements from the Iranian government at various levels over the past couple weeks. If you recall, we were talking about this in New York, which seems like it was just last week. a couple weeks ago now. And we have heard from the Iranians that they expect negotiations to resume soon. We hope their definition of soon matches our definition of soon. We would like negotiations to resume in Vienna as soon as possible. We have been saying this not for weeks now, but for months now. We think it is important for the parties to come back together, to continue to resume where we left off in Vienna after the sixth round, so that we can resume this seventh round on the basis of what we have accomplished to date. We think it is important for a number of reasons, but also because, as we have made very clear, we continue to believe the diplomatic path is open. We continue to believe that a diplomatic approach is the best means to verifiably once again ensure that Iran can never obtain a nuclear weapon with the permanent and verifiable restrictions that the JCPOA put in place. But we also think a imminent return to Vienna is necessary because this is not a process that can go on indefinitely. This is not a process that can drag out or that can be dragged out. We are firmly of the belief that we need to work quickly. We need to work with alacrity and a great deal of speed to see to it if we can achieve that mutual return to compliance that we have been sincere and steadfast in seeking to achieve for the better part of a year now.
Hinging on what? I mean,
it's hinging on the Iranians.
Who's going to take
it? It is hinging on the Iranians. We have made very clear that we are prepared, willing, and able to return to Vienna as soon as we have a partner to negotiate with indirectly. We have also made clear that we would be happy to engage in direct negotiations. And in fact, this process would be much more effective if we had a direct negotiating partner. The Iranians have not been willing to do that, as we know. The Iranians have heretofore not been willing to return to Vienna just yet. We have heard these repeated statements of soon, of within days. Again, we hope their lexicon matches ours when it comes to this. Andrea.
Thank you, and we're all really happy to see you well.
Thank you.
It's a great advertisement for vaccinations.
Yes, thank you.
On Iran, can you expand on the conversations between the secretary and Foreign Minister Lavrov in terms of what the Russians are willing to do, if they are, to help persuade the Iranians to come back to the talks? And I have a follow-up.
Well, the secretary did not have an opportunity to speak to Foreign Minister Lavrov yesterday. The brunt of the conversation was on a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA. We have, of course, it goes without saying, we have a number of profound disagreements with the Russian Federation. There are areas where our interests do align, and this is one of them. Russia, the Russian Federation, is an original member of the P5 plus one. Russia has been constructive in its engagement in the context of the P5 plus one. We agree with the Russian Federation that Iran should not be able to acquire a nuclear weapon. That is precisely why we and the Russians agree on this one issue, that we should resume negotiations in Vienna as soon as possible. The Russians similarly read out this call, made similar points. This is one of those issues where our interests do, in fact, overlap.
And there was a number of years ago, there were a number of conversations before the JCPOA about the Russians being involved in a deal with the Iranians on buying some of their processed uranium. Is there any thought of that, of the Russians stepping in any way?
Well, right now the thought is on resuming the mutual compliance with the JCPOA, testing the proposition that we can achieve that mutual return to compliance. United States, the Russian Federation, our other partners in the P5 plus one context, all of us are united in the belief that the JCPOA continues to provide the best and the most effective framework for achieving our mutual interests. It is a mutual interest on the part of the United States, of France, of Germany, of the United Kingdom, of the European Union, of Russia and China, that Iran should not be able to acquire a nuclear weapon. So, look, we're not entertaining at the moment, or at least not discussing publicly, other modalities, other alternatives, because we still have a framework in the form of the JCPOA that would provide precisely what we would like to see, precisely what our partners and allies in the P5 plus one would like to see, and what Iran was willing to agree to. As recently as 2015, implementation in 2016, and certainly the last government in Iran being willing to engage in good faith, business-like, indirect, but business-like negotiations in Vienna. That's what we would like to see happen, to see if we can affect that mutual return to compliance. Yes. Anything else on Iran?
I have one more Iran
sure.
question.
I have another question on another topic. The Namazi, I saw the tweet earlier this
yes.
week. Are you getting any indications that Iran is going to offer any kind of humanitarian gesture on that case?
Well, these are cases that I will say a couple things about. These are cases that, in the first instance, we are prioritizing to the utmost degree. This is something we have done in parallel, but independently of discussions regarding a mutual return to compliance with the JCPOA, precisely because we do not want or wish to potentially tie the fates of detained Americans and others to the fate of a proposition that has always been uncertain. We want to see these Americans released. They have been held against their will for far too long. The fact that they have been held against their will unjustly, without basis, without cause, for this period, for any period, is an abomination. It is especially jarring in this case, in the case of Mr. Namazi, given the serious medical condition that he has, his need to receive urgent medical care. And so we are appealing, and we have appealed, to the Iranian government to do what is right, to do what is just, to do what is humane in this and all cases, and to release Mr. Namazi and the other unjustly detained Americans in their custody. We have long made the point that using human beings, individuals, for political leverage has no place in foreign policy. It has no place in the international system. It does not afford any country, whether that is Iran or any other country, any additional leverage. And in fact, it just leads to international condemnation. We have worked closely with a number of our allies and partners. We've recently spoken to this in the Canadian context, and in fact, our Canadian allies have launched an initiative to establish a norm, to see to it that the practice of holding individuals for the purposes of political leverage is something that is cast aside, is something that no country resorts to. Obviously, we have a lot of work to do. We are working this in the case of Iran. We are working this in the case of all other countries where this occurs.
Question, but I can come back after.
Sure. Okay, go ahead, please.
Thank you. Good to see you.
Yes.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So the secretary is in Mexico tomorrow, and he will be talking about security arrangements. The Mexicans say Mérida is dead, this agreement that has been sort of the bedrock of U.S.-Mexican security relations for more than a decade is dead. Do you agree that, do you, the State Department, the Biden administration, agree that Mérida is dead, or at least has outlived its usefulness, A? And B, as you negotiate a new arrangement, what are the two or three elements that the U.S. really wants to see in any kind of future security arrangement with Mexico?
Well, as you alluded to, the secretary will be in Mexico tomorrow on Friday to take part in this high-level security dialogue. He'll be there with his counterparts from the Department of Justice, the Department of Homeland Security, the Attorney General, and the Homeland Security secretary to discuss precisely this set of issues. When it comes to Mérida, look, this is an initiative that has been on the books for, I think it is 13 years now. We believe we are due for an updated look at our bilateral security cooperation, and we need an approach that addresses the concerns and the priorities of both governments. And this will really be one of the core elements of the discussions tomorrow. Our foreign assistance has supported deeper law enforcement assistance and coordination and information sharing between our countries, and it has helped strengthen ties between our security agencies and help strengthen that security relationship more broadly. We also know that the Mérida Initiative helped Mexico strengthen rule of law and counter-narcotics capacity, and has enabled Mexican law enforcement agencies' international accreditation at the federal and state levels, resulting in increased transparency, professionalization of institutions, and respect for human rights. And our security cooperation has strengthened as threats from fentanyl and illicit finance has evolved. So all of this will be on the table, and more tomorrow will be on the table. The Mérida Initiative has produced some significant gains. We want to see to it that those gains are preserved, that cooperation is deepened, and that we have an updated approach that accounts for the threats of today and the threats that have evolved over the course of the some 15 years that Mérida has been in place. Yes?
In perhaps a new forum or a new agreement?
We don't have anything to announce yet in terms of what that might look like, what that might mean. But certainly we want to see to it that our mutually beneficial cooperation with Mexico continues on these important security matters. The high-level security dialogue tomorrow will be the natural complement to the economic dialogue that took place with our Mexican partners a couple weeks ago now. You had an opportunity to hear from the Secretary yesterday just how productive those discussions were on the economic front. I know that the Secretary, I know that our counterparts from DHS and the Department of Justice are similarly hoping and expecting for a constructive discussion on the security issues tomorrow in an effort to deepen that cooperation further. Said.
Add my voice to my colleagues and welcoming you and seeing you behind.
Thanks very much.
The podium there. Very quick, couple of questions on the Palestinian-Israeli issue. The Israeli press reported yesterday that the Biden administration is quietly and behind the scenes is putting pressure on the Israeli government to freeze settlements. You know, there was a big, I guess, plan, or a huge plan for a huge settlement. Can you comment on this? Do you guys, what is your position on the settlements?
Well, part of your question I will comment on, part of your question I won't comment on. I'll start with the latter. We don't comment on private diplomatic conversations, private conversations that may be taking place, whether that's between the Secretary and his counterpart and the President and his counterpart. But what we have said many times before is that we believe it is critical for all parties to refrain from unilateral steps that exacerbate tensions and undercut efforts to advance a negotiated two-state solution. That, of course, includes settlement activity.
No, Ned, I mean, you guys have always stuck to this line, you know, about, you know, anything that would prejudice the two-state solution outcome and so on. But in fact, you say unilateral steps, we're talking about one side who's doing this, which is Israel. It is taking the land. It is throwing people out. It is making, you know, the two-state outcome almost impossible. So why... What is there left for the United States to do in order to pressure Israel to end these activities that actually render the two-state solution almost impossible to attain?
Saeed, the two-state solution is something we discuss with our Israeli partners at just about every opportunity. It continues to be the guiding principle for our approach to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And it continues to be the guiding principle, the guiding framework for a simple reason. The two-state solution is the best means by which to protect Israel's identity as a Jewish and democratic state while affording to the Palestinian people what they have long sought. And that includes self-determination, dignity, safety, security, prosperity in a state of their own. And so that is why we've remained focused on this. Look, we don't always, and in fact, we never read out our private diplomatic conversations, the back and forth we have, whether that's with our Israeli partners or any partner around the world. But suffice to say, we have made our position very clear. And when it comes to unilateral action like settlement activity, we have also made that very clear. And in fact, I just reiterated where the United States stands on settlement activity. There should be no question about that.
Last thing on the settler violence. It is, I know you guys addressed that last week, but this has increased. I mean, the settlers are not deterred. The Israeli government is not doing, Israeli forces are not doing anything. They just watch as they attack today. They attacked a seven-year-old girl. I mean, it's happening every single day. They're throwing people out and so on. Why can't you take a stronger stand on settler violence?
Saeed, I think we have taken a strong stand on settler violence. And you saw our statement the other day. We made very clear in that statement that the United States government, that this administration strongly condemns the acts of settler violence that took place against Palestinians in villages near Hebron and the West Bank on September 28th. We appreciate Foreign Minister Lapid and other Israeli officials' strong and unequivocal condemnation of this violence. And again, look, we believe it is critical for all parties to refrain from those unilateral steps that exacerbate tensions and, again, undercut efforts to achieve a negotiated two-state solution. That includes, as I was saying before in a different context, annexation of territory, settlement activity, demolitions and evictions, incitement to violence, and providing compensation for individuals imprisoned for acts of terrorism. We have been very clear on all of those things, just as we were on the settler violence that you referenced within recent days. Yes, Michelle. Sure.
Senator Blumenthal says that two charter flights have left Mazar-e-Sharif and made it to Doha with 800 Americans and Afghan allies. I wonder, one, what role the State Department played in any of that, and two, how many Americans do you think are still in need of evacuation?
Well, let me start with that second question first. This is a figure that continues to be dynamic, and it continues to be dynamic because it's a number that goes down with each flight, with each overland transfer, with each departure of a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident from Afghanistan for those who wish to do so. It also goes up because, especially in recent weeks, because we have been quite successful with our efforts to facilitate the departure of Americans and lawful permanent residents and others who wish to depart Afghanistan. You've seen that in the context of the flights that have departed from Kabul International Airport. You referenced some of the private charter flights as well. I made a reference to overland transfers additionally. Since August 31st, we have assisted 105 U.S. citizens and 95 lawful permanent residents to depart. An additional number of U.S. citizens and LPRs have departed on charter on charters or have independently on their own crossed a land border. Those figures that I cited, 105 citizens and 95 lawful permanent residents, those are individuals that the United States government directly facilitated, whose departure we directly facilitated, I should say. When it comes to the issue of charters, we are not in a position to confirm the private charters that depart Kabul and that depart Kabul or Mazar-e-Sharif, as the case might be, because of operational security considerations, because of our desire not to in any way impede such operations. But let me make a couple broad points. When it comes to private efforts to facilitate the departure of Americans, of lawful permanent residents, and others from Afghanistan, there are really two elements to relocating these groups of people. One, there is arranging the departure and safe passage out of Afghanistan. But there is also the issue of where these individuals can go temporarily, as well as eventually, to resettle permanently. And when it comes to the Department of State, we have been working very closely with the Department of Defense and other interagency partners, as well as with many of these outside groups and entities, to evaluate requests for assistance on a case-by-case basis to support these privately organized flights. This support takes any number of forms, but it does involve evaluating the passenger manifests provided to us by the private groups or by the private group or groups, as the case might be, organizing these flights to see which proposed passengers, if any, may be potentially eligible for permanent resettlement in the United States through some affiliation with the U.S. government. Now, in many cases, and you have heard this from many of these private groups, we have provided that direct and effective assistance. Again, we don't confirm on a case-by-case basis, but many of the groups have spoken to our assistance and support. That is not to say that these private charters are not without challenge, and we've also spoken of the challenges that these present. We've made the point that without personnel on the ground in Mazar-e-Sharif, in this case, it is we are unable to ensure the fidelity of intended manifests, and there is no ability on the part of the U.S. government directly to determine whether the passengers aboard the plane would be eligible for relocation or for resettlement in the United States. Now, there have been several instances in which private entities have chartered aircraft to transport individuals out of Afghanistan where identity checks on arrival at transit destinations have revealed that many of the passengers were not, in fact, eligible for relocation in the United States, and in some cases, that despite our best vetting and vetting to the best of our ability, the manifests were not accurate. And when this happens, it does put these individuals in a very difficult spot. It puts them at risk with no plan for relocation to the United States. It has the potential, we are cognizant of the fact that it has the potential to damage the bilateral relationship when it involves landing in a third country, as it does in these cases. And it makes it more difficult for the U.S. government to rely on partner countries to assist in future relocations out of Afghanistan. So that is why we go to great and, I would say, extraordinary efforts on the front end, working with groups or individual groups to do all we can to vet manifests on the front end, to provide each and every form of assistance we can, to see to it that where there are manifests, where we feel we have a good sense of the fidelity of that manifest, and that manifest provides us with an ability to relocate, to move many of these people through the system, and ultimately to relocate them to the United States, we have been in a position to provide that assistance on any number of occasions. But again, we just don't speak about individual flights for that reason. So sticking with Afghanistan, Afghanistan, we'll come back to Mexico.
Can you answer a question about how many Americans do you think are left since you've taken 100 out and you were telling us about 100 were there, but that number changes? And then if you're facilitating, to the extent that you just talked about, trying to validate these passenger manifests, and you said before you're working on landing rights for some of these flights, at least you were, you have to have some idea of the number of people who've gotten out on charter flights. Can you give us guidance on either of those things?
Well, we are, again, striving to provide data that is both timely and that is accurate. And the data that is most accurate is that data that entails operations that the United States government ourselves have facilitated. And so that's why we have, until now, spoken to the 105 U.S. citizens and 95 LPRs that we have directly, whose departure from Afghanistan we have directly facilitate it. We are aware of other U.S. citizens and LPRs who have been aboard private charter flights. We have a sense of that from the manifests. But again, where these operations are not ones that we are directly facilitating, in the first instance, we have usually less fidelity there, and so we are reticent to provide precise figures there, although in the case of many of these private charters, I know groups have provided their own numbers to give you some sense of roughly what this universe may look like. When it comes to the number of Americans who remain in Afghanistan, this is a figure, again, that is dynamic. We said as of a couple weeks ago, the figure was around 100 Americans in Afghanistan who wished to depart at that time. This, of course, since then, several dozen Americans have departed Afghanistan with our assistance or via other means. But we're also aware that, again, as we have demonstrated our ability to affect the departure from Afghanistan of Americans who wish to leave, others have raised their hands. And so this is a number that is changing by the day. And it is a number that is by no means static. So
is dozens, is that?
We are certainly in contact with dozens of Americans in Afghanistan who wish to leave. But it is difficult for us to put a firm figure on it just because people are departing. And as Americans in Afghanistan who previously may not have made themselves known to us or previously may have told us, I am content to stay here or I'm going to stay here for various reasons, as they see our ability to facilitate the departure of Americans and LPRs, they are raising their hands for the first time or changing their calculus after seeing that. Afghanistan? Connor? Sure.
The number that you provided of 105 U.S. citizens and 95 LPRs, that's the same number from about a week and a half ago?
That's right.
Why haven't, I mean, is there been a difficulty getting in touch with people? Why haven't you been able to facilitate more Americans getting out?
It's a combination of a number of things. There's a universe of Americans who wish to leave. There is a smaller universe of Americans who are fully prepared to leave in various ways, whether that means they or their family members have travel documents, are ready to leave at this moment. That's a smaller universe than the universe of Americans that we're in touch with that have expressed some desire to leave. We work closely with our partners when it comes to flights, when it comes to flights departing Kabul International Airport. We have continued to work very closely with our Qatari partners on this as well. As you know, they've been able to facilitate the departure of dozens of Americans and LPRs on charters aboard their aircraft. We've also been able to do this via overland routes. We are continuing to work with partners and to communicate with Americans on the ground on regarding future opportunities to depart Afghanistan, should they choose to do so.
Given that number, though, it was a senior State Department official who said that there were about 100 U.S. citizens and LPRs in Kabul ready to go that you guys were working with. Did that group get out?
So I believe what you're referring to was just a few days ago when that senior State Department official made that statement. There have not, to my knowledge, been any USG facilitated flights departing Kabul International Airport since then, but this is something that we are always in the background working to arrange with our Qatari partners, working closely with our Turkish partners on the ground as well when it comes to KIA operations. And then we're in constant and regular touch with Americans regarding other avenues to depart the country if they should choose to do so, including overland.
There's apparently, can you provide any update on the number of Afghans who were evacuated and then have been sort of red flagged and had to be moved elsewhere? How large is that group of people, and what your plans are to do with them?
I cannot, the Department of Homeland Security may be in a better position to provide you specific figures. What I can say is that the processing, the security vetting that you're referring to is a process that entails reviews by the Department of Homeland Security, by law enforcement, by our intelligence community. In many cases, these reviews are able to be conducted expeditiously and result in an all clear in a relatively short period of time. There have been cases where we have been unable to secure an expeditious resolution of a particular case. In such instances, additional checking does tend to verify that the person is who she or he says they are, and that person is able to continue on with their journey. So sometimes it does take a bit longer, but the continuous checks and vetting in nearly all cases that I'm aware of has resulted in resolution and the ability of individuals to continue their travel in relatively short order. Yes, please. Well,
I want to ask you India about Deputy Secretary Sirmann's visit to India. What were the key points of a travel visit there? What were the main issues of discussions during our meetings in Delhi?
Well, the Deputy Secretary, as you said, has been in India over the past couple days. She is has just concluded her visit, and she will be moving on to Pakistan from there. She has had an opportunity to engage substantively and constructively with some of our key interlocutors. She had a meeting with the Foreign Secretary, Harsh Shringla. They discussed, as we often do with our Indian partners, growing security, economic, and Indo-Pacific convergence between India and the United States, including around topics that are of mutual interest to both of our countries, ending the COVID-19 pandemic, combating the climate crisis, and accelerating clean energy deployment, deepening trade and investment ties, and expanding cooperation on cybersecurity and emerging technology. We, of course, have worked closely with India over the course of many months now, after an announcement that emerged from the first virtual Quad Leader Summit about India's role as a key COVID vaccine manufacturer for the region. And so this is one of the many areas where we have enjoyed a deep and collaborative relationship with India. In the course of that meeting, they also discussed pressing regional and global security challenges. That includes those posed by events in Afghanistan, Iran, Russia, the People's Republic of China. They also discussed ongoing efforts to return Myanmar to a path to democracy. The deputy also had an opportunity to meet with Indian Minister of External Affairs, Dr. Jaishankar. They discussed some of these same issues, but overall, this was an opportunity for the United States to deepen our strategic partnership with India, a partnership that affords opportunities for both countries, and a partnership that is incredibly important to us as we seek to underscore and to underline a free and open Indo-Pacific. And India, to us, as a member of the Quad, as an important geopolitical partner, is an instrumental element to that overarching goal.
One quick one. Yes. Were you able to decide on the dates for the 2+2 next month here in D.C.?
I don't have anything to announce in terms of a future meeting. Andrea?
Do you have any better understanding of China's intentions regarding Taiwan after Jake Sullivan's meetings, and anything else about the fact that this will only be a virtual meeting between the two leaders rather than an in-person meeting?
Go ahead.
Okay.
So when it comes to Taiwan, let me take that first. And you've heard from the State Department, you've heard from the White House on this in recent days, but we are very concerned by the PRC's provocative military actions near Taiwan. As we said, this activity is destabilizing. It risks miscalculations. It undermines regional peace and stability. And so we strongly urge Beijing to cease its military, diplomatic, and economic pressure and coercion against Taiwan. We've said this many times before, but our commitment to Taiwan is rock solid, and it contributes, we believe, to the maintenance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and within the broader region as well. And so we'll continue to stand with our friends and allies to advance our shared prosperity, security, and values. And we'll continue to deepen our ties with a democratic Taiwan. The other point I would make is one of the elements that I think distinguishes our approach, not only to the PRC, but also our approach to Taiwan, is that it is not something that we are speaking to ourselves. And you have seen over the course of many months now that we have been able to raise the priority of this issue on the agenda. It featured in the joint statement with Prime Minister Suga in April of 2021 when he visited the White House. It similarly featured in the joint statement after President Moon's visit in May of this year. The G7 communique in June of this year made a reference to the importance of peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait. And the more recent Osman statement from last month, September of this year, says that Taiwan holds an important role in the Indo-Pacific region, and we invite you to join us in maintaining and expanding strong ties with Taiwan. So this is something that, consistent with our broader approach to the Indo-Pacific, consistent with our broader approach to the PRC, we have worked concertedly with allies, with partners in Europe, in the Indo-Pacific, around the world, to make very clear not only where the United States stands, but also where we stand together with our allies and partners. Yes, Michel. Sure.
Did you have anything on the so-called virtual summit?
In terms of the virtual summit, I know that the White House made clear yesterday that President Biden and President Xi would have an opportunity to convene virtually before the end of the year, but I don't have any additional details beyond that. Yes.
First, on Libya, the U.S. has been pushing the Libyans to hold the elections on December 24th, but yesterday the parliament has postponed Libya's legislative elections until January instead of being held on December 24th as planned. Are you aware of that? Do you have any comment, and how will you deal with this?
We are aware of that. Our goal when it comes to Libya is a sovereign, stable, unified, and secure Libya with no foreign interference and a democratically elected government that supports human rights and development and that is capable of combating terrorism within our borders. And so that's why we've increased our diplomatic focus on supporting that progress in Libya, including through the work of our special envoy, Richard Norland. Now, we know that elections, free and fair elections, are a core part of that. There is an urgent need for Libyan leaders to come up with creative compromises on an electoral framework. As we underscored in Berlin in the conference that Foreign Minister Maas convened in June, and the UN Security Council session on Libya the following month in July, the international community expects national elections to take place in the roadmap adopted by the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum, and we welcome that in UN Security Council Resolution 2570 in April. So the conduct of free and fair elections, holding of free and fair elections, is extraordinarily important to us. It is something that we will continue to work with our partners in the international community to continue to support as we work to help the Libyan people achieve their broader aspirations.
Do you prefer both elections, presidential and parliamentary elections, to be held in the same day instead of being held one in December and the second in January?
I don't know if we have a position on that. If we do, we'll get back to you.
One more on
or two more. One on Egypt, a delegation of Egyptian parliamentarians and politicians is visiting Washington this week to discuss human rights in Egypt. Did any official in this building meet with the delegation?
Yes, I can confirm that our acting assistant secretary for our Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs, Yael Lempert, did meet with members of the dialogue Dialogue International Task Force visiting today from Egypt. We welcome this visit and the opportunity to discuss our ongoing concerns about human rights in Egypt. The delegation included two individuals nominated by Egypt's parliament to the National Council for Human Rights. That's Chairman Mohamed Anwar al-Sadat and board member and ambassador Mushira Khattab. We have, as we've made very clear, concerns related to human rights in Egypt, and we've relayed those concerns directly to Egyptian authorities on any number of occasions. Such meetings can provide productive ways to engage on these concerns and show the United States support for Egypt in achieving the objectives set out in its own national human rights strategy, which it launched last month.
And Iran-Lebanon, a third tanker containing a shipment of Iranian oil destined for Lebanon docked in Syria's Banias port on Wednesday, and they are on their way to Lebanon. Are you aware of that too, and what's your reaction?
We are aware of that, and what we would say is that broadly speaking, fuel from a country subject to extensive sanctions like Iran is not very clearly a sustainable solution to Lebanon's energy crisis. We support efforts to find transparent and sustainable energy solutions that will address Lebanon's acute energy and fuel shortages. This is, in our minds, Hezbollah playing a public relations game, not engaged in constructive problem solving.
On Iran?
Again, there is no change in terms of our approach to these sanctions. We do not foresee that until and unless we are able to achieve a mutual return to compliance, as we are eagerly seeking to do. We'll move around. Please.
Thanks. I have a question about China. There's been a lot of focus on the tone of the meeting yesterday, especially compared to the one in March in Alaska. And, you know, people kind of thinking about what that might mean for the U.S.-China relationship and where it's going. So I was hoping you could clarify just kind of a fundamental question about where things stand right now, which is, has anything at all changed in the U.S.-China relationship and where it's going between that first meeting in March and right now?
Well, look, I think there is a mistaken assumption out there that our relationship with the PRC is binary, that either we're in a period of engagement with the PRC or we're in a period of confrontation with the PRC. That is fundamentally just not how it works. At least it's not how it works today. Our relationship with Beijing is one that is dynamic. It is one that is multifaceted. It is one that, at its core, is defined by stiff competition. And the point of this engagement is to see to it that through dialogue, including at high levels, as took place yesterday between the National Security Advisor and Director Yang, to see to it that we can manage this competition responsibly. That is the dynamic that is with us now. It's what we expect the dynamic to be going forward. There are, when it comes to our relationship with the PRC, there are areas of competition. And again, most of our engagement with the PRC is predicated on this idea of competition, and in many cases, stiff competition. It is a relationship that in some ways is adversarial. And our goal, of course, is to minimize these points of friction in the relationship, and part of that is engaging constructively in dialogue with our partners, with the PRC. And there are also areas where there is room for cooperation, and we've spoken to some of those areas for cooperation and potential areas for cooperation, working together on climate change, committing to it that we work together, that we work constructively to address the existential challenge of climate change, the existential threat of climate change that poses that very threat not only to the United States, but also to the PRC. And it's especially important that we do so when you have the world's largest emitter and the world's second largest emitter coming to the table and taking responsible action and demonstrating leadership, raising that level of ambition, not only for the sake of our own two countries, but also to galvanize action on the part of countries the world over. So we will, and you heard from the White House yesterday, there will be an opportunity for the president to engage directly with President Xi in the coming months. This is very much part of that belief that in order to manage the relationship, in order to establish and reinforce those guardrails on the relationship, there needs to be dialogue. It doesn't fundamentally shift the nature of the relationship. It is a relationship that is complex. It is a relationship that is dynamic. It's a relationship that's multifaceted. And when it comes to the PRC or any other challenge that we face, we can do multiple things at once. Daphne.
On Mexico, could you share a bit more what the U.S. hopes to see come out of the security dialogue tomorrow? Will the U.S. raise Haitian migrants moving to the U.S. border through Mexico, and what will that message be if so? And should we expect any sort of announcement on the Merida initiative?
I don't want to get too far ahead of tomorrow because tomorrow is another day, but also because we are doing a call to preview this engagement this afternoon. I will just say that this dialogue comes at an opportune moment, and it's opportune because the threats of the 21st century are complex, they are dynamic, they are also threats that we need to confront together. These are threats that are transnational. These are threats that, by definition, no borders. And so that is why this dialogue, the highest level dialogue to date in this administration of this sort, will build on previous discussions that we've had with our Mexican partners in terms of how to protect our people, how to prevent transborder crime, how to best pursue criminal networks, while also promoting human rights and the rule of law. So we'll have much more to say on this today, and of course, the Secretary and his counterparts will have more to say tomorrow.
Completely separate issue, Western Sahara.
Yes.
The Secretary put out a statement yesterday welcoming Stefan de Mistura's appointment as the UN Special Representative on Western Sahara. Could you go into what you're expecting from this? In terms of his discussions, the U.S. position that Western Sahara is under Moroccan sovereignty, is that a position that that is up for review? Is that something you're willing to discuss? What do you see?
Well, as you heard from the Secretary yesterday, we strongly support personal envoy de Mistura's leadership in resuming the UN-led political process to advance a durable and dignified solution to the conflict in Western Sahara. We will actively support his efforts to promote a peaceful and prosperous future for the people of Western Sahara and the broader region. We remain engaged with all sides in support of that effort, and we'll support a credible UN-led political process to stabilize the situation and secure a cessation of any hostilities. We are consulting with the parties about how best to achieve that lasting settlement. We don't have anything further to announce at this time. As I said, we are consulting with the parties about how best to achieve that lasting settlement.
So the U.S. still considers Western Sahara to be under Moroccan, to be legitimately part of Morocco?
We don't have anything to announce beyond what we've said. Yes?
So I have a question on China and North Korea, and I seriously think we should talk more about in the Pacific if the United States is seriously think that in the Pacific is important. So regarding China, President Biden said that he and President Xi will abide by a Taiwan agreement. And of course, he meant the agreement about Taiwan, but it just caused some confusion and anxiety in Taiwan. So can you just clarify what he meant with that with the Taiwan agreement. And my second question is about North Korea. And so the World Health Organization has started shipment of COVID medical supply to North Korea. And I remember like 3 weeks ago, the U.S. Special Envoy, Ambassador Sung Kim, he said that he was prepared to closely work with North Korea to address the humanitarian concerns. And so do you can you share any progress on that front?
Sure, I'll take those in turn. First on Taiwan, the president, the State Department, we have been clear and consistent that our policy for some 4 decades now has that is to say our One China policy has been guided by the Taiwan Relations Act, by the 3 joint communiques, and the 6 assurances provided to Taipei. Those documents form the basis of our approach to Taiwan and to cross-strait relations. When it comes to North Korea, look, we've made this point the world over. Even when we disagree with a particular regime, we believe that we must work to the best of our ability to do all we can to alleviate the suffering of the people. And so we continue to support international efforts aimed at the provision of critical humanitarian aid to the DPRK. It's important to emphasize at the same time that the DPRK regime itself is primarily responsible for the humanitarian situation in the country. The regime continues to exploit its own citizens, to violate their human rights, to divert resources from the country's people, to build up its unlawful WMD and ballistic missiles program. But we do support efforts to alleviate the suffering of the North Korean people. We are involved in efforts to facilitate the provision of humanitarian aid to the neediest in North Korea. This is most evident, I would say, in our ongoing work to expedite approvals in the UN 1718 Committee for organizations from around the world to deliver life-saving aid to the DPRK.
So I have one follow-up question on that. So yesterday, the UN Special Representative for Human Rights in North Korea, he said that basically, he called on that the UN sanctions against North Korea should be reviewed and eased to facilitate humanitarian assistance. So can you just clarify how the United States view the relations between the UN sanctions against North Korea and the humanitarian aid?
Well, I believe he was referring to the UN sanctions regime, not the U.S. Sanctions regime. Look, we have made very clear that our policy calls for a calibrated, practical approach that seeks serious and sustained diplomacy with the DPRK to make tangible progress that increases the security of the United States, our allies, and our deployed forces. Our goal remains the complete denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula, and to that end, we remain prepared to meet with the DPRK without preconditions, anytime, anywhere. We have made specific proposals for discussions with the DPRK in our messages to them, and we hope that they respond positively to our outreach. Again, we support efforts to alleviate the humanitarian suffering of the North Korean people, cognizant that, again, it is far too often the regime that is the cause of that suffering. We also know that whether it's our own sanctions regime, whether it's the UN sanctions regime, there are certainly carve-outs in these regimes to ensure that in the first instance, we are not doing anything that would compound the suffering, the deprivation of the North Korean people. Thank you all very much. We'll see you next week.